morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Right now, I would like to welcome Jetsumna Tenzin Palmo. She is a Tibetan Buddhist nun and teacher, and she will be speaking at the Lenzik this Wednesday, tomorrow, November 5th at 7:30, in a talk titled Seeking the Heart of Wisdom. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And by the way, today is election day, ladies and gentlemen. If you haven't voted already, get out there and vote. It's your right and it's your duty. So you sat in a cave in the Himalayas meditating and practicing for 12 years. What was the nature of your calling that led you to what probably many of us consider such an extreme way of life?
Well, I was born in England and brought up in London. And then when I was 18, I read a book about Buddhism and realized that was my path. So this was in the early 60s when there were very few Buddhist teachers in the West. So I decided I had to go where the teachers were. So I went to India because, of course, the Tibetans had been fleeing from Tibet with the Dalai Lama since 59. And then I met my Lama on my 21st birthday, which was very auspicious, and stayed with him for some years. Then eventually he told me that I should go to this Himalayan Valley of Lahul to practice. So I went there and stayed for about 6 years in a monastery there. Then wishing for more seclusion in order to concentrate on my practices, I heard about a cave which was even further up the mountain, and so I went there.
And so you never were called to family life or other types of professions?
No, I mean, since I was a small child, I wanted to be a nun. I was a bit puzzled as to why, because I wasn't particularly Christian. But I knew since I had been a small child that I was going to be a nun.
And so you did this practice, you devoted yourself to it, and describe in layman's, describe in any terms what it is that when you are in that situation that you do all day.
Well, basically, in the Tibetan tradition, the day is divided up into four practice sections of about 3 hours each. And so one would get up before dawn, usually around 3, and do a first session, and then have breakfast, then clean up a bit, then do the second session, then have lunch, then a bit of a rest, and then the third section, and then the fourth session. And then that was it for the day.
And so, but you also, being there all by yourself, have to take care of yourself, grow your own food, presumably, and do your own laundry or what? I mean, what was your life like?
Well, yes, of course. There was no electricity, obviously, and there was no running water. So one had to get water from about half a mile away from a spring. And in the summer, then I grew some turnips and potatoes. And the year from about November to May was snow, very heavy snow in that area. It's about 12,000 feet. So then you couldn't go for the water. So then there was a thing of having to melt snow. And I don't know if you ever melted snow around here, but I mean, a big bucket of snow gets a very small amount of water.
Right.
And then there was also a lot of work in clearing off the snow so that one could move outside. And I don't know, and then I didn't eat after midday, so and usually I cooked enough food it's very cold, so it would last for the week. You know, I just every day heat up a bit of food.
So you have made a commitment to attain enlightenment in the female form, no matter how many lifetimes that takes. Am I understanding correctly?
Well, it's simply I got a bit fed up with the fact that all the emphasis was on having this male body, as if that was somehow, you know, a sine qua non for attaining enlightenment, which seemed to me, well, the texts are all written by men, you know. So I just felt one time, having been told yet again, no, we don't teach this to women, that I was going to damn them all and attain enlightenment as a female, because we have so few examples. I mean, I think women shouldn't be praying, well, as they do in Asia, to come back in a male body, that we should really sort of hold hands together and say we can do it as females.
What are the, if any, advantages and disadvantages for women in doing a meditation practice?
Well, apparently, many meditation teachers, not just Tibetans, but others, have said that if the women's minds tend to be more volatile, more up and down and emotional.
Do you think that's true?
Well, I think it depends on the woman. But on the whole, you know, the feeling is that they're more kind of up and down. But if they can get that together and deal with that, then just because of that, they have so much more energy to go up more quickly and higher.
So the same energy which creates volatility creates a path,
impetus,
a spiritual path.
Yes, yes. And also, I met one very senior meditation teacher in Burma who, to my surprise actually, told me that his best meditators were just simple lay women, because when he told them to do something, they just did it. And then they got the result. Whereas if they told the monks, then they were saying, oh, but such and such a person, he said we should do this. And then somebody else said we should do that. And maybe, you know, we should adapt it. And just thinking about it, not able to actually just plunge in and do it. So he said that his female disciples were therefore got to the goal so much quicker, because they just did it. And also, many other teachers also say that women feel at home in the intuitive, in a way that, and of course, some males are highly intuitive too, and some women are very rational, but in general, they're not so threatened by something which isn't necessarily very logical and very rational, and they feel unthreatened by it.
And that helps them in a spiritual practice.
Absolutely.
There's also something that you talk about in the book that was written about your life, namely the ability that women have to love their children and the possibility of loving the world as they love their children.
Mm. Well, the Buddha said that we should love all beings just as a mother loves her only child. And, of course, you know, most women can immediately identify with that. So, but the loving the only child is the easy bit. The problem is then extending that intensity of great love towards all beings.
So just getting back, I mean, I've never met anybody who has been in a cave for so long. It's an amazing thing to contemplate. I mean, I was trying to imagine what your life was like, and I think that there's something that when you see the same landscape, the same environment every day, it doesn't change, but your response to it might change. So the seasons go around, but one year maybe winter is annoying and another year winter is wonderful. I mean, how did you observe yourself and have the freedom to observe yourself in that solitude?
Well, I mean, the whole point of being in solitude is that one doesn't have so much external distraction. And so one is faced with one's mind. And, I mean, normally if someone is feeling depressed or a bit bored, then they turn on the television or they go for a walk, they call up their friends or whatever. But obviously if you are in an isolated place in solitude, no matter what happens, there's nowhere you can escape to. And you are just faced with looking at your own mind, and you have to deal with it, which is great. I mean, it's one of the reasons for being in solitary retreats. There's no escape.
So To what extent are you using, when you're on a solitary retreat like that, scripture versus doing your own practice of meditation?
Well, I mean, in the Tibetan tradition, the practices are set up. But then, of course, each person is dealing with their own mind and their own mind's reactions to those practices. So, I mean, there's a basic form, but within that, of course, it develops as you go along.
And so did you read Buddhist texts every day?
Usually. At that time, I was only reading in Tibetan.
We're talking to Tenzin Palmo, who is here visiting Santa Fe and will be at the Lenzik tomorrow night in a talk titled Seeking the Heart of Wisdom. How did you know when it was time to finish?
Well, how I knew was because I heard somebody making a noise outside my traditional meditation boundaries, and then next thing I knew, somebody knocked on the door. And when I opened the door, there was this poor little, very exhausted policeman outside saying, "Excuse me, you've been in the country illegally for 3 years and you've got 48 hours to leave." That kind of finished the retreat.
So that was how it ended.
Mm.
Would you have stayed? Would you still be there if he hadn't come up?
Probably not, but I had a few more months to go on my three-year retreat. I'd done 3 years, but you're supposed to do 3 years and 3 months, and I hadn't finished the 3 months. But after that, I was thinking that I had been by that time 24 years in India, and I needed a break. So I got a break a little bit earlier than I expected.
So what did you do? I mean, leaving aside the absurdity of visas and somebody being in the country illegally when they're so invisible to everybody else. But what did you do next? What happened after that?
Well, after that, first of all, I went with a friend to South India to do a sort of pilgrimage down there. And then I left and went to Italy I lived in the hills outside of Assisi.
And did you teach meditation to the Italians?
To a certain extent. From time to time, I would go and give talks. But mainly what I was trying to do there was to explore Western culture. I mean, since I was 18, when I became Buddhist, I had been totally absorbed in Asian culture. And I felt now that, you know, as I say, this was, I don't know, about 20 years, 30 years later, that I needed to reconnect with my own culture again. And of course, where better than Italy? So I spent quite a lot of time reading books on Catholic spirituality and visiting many art galleries and churches and just absorbing myself into Western culture for a change.
And what was that like, and how did it connect or not connect to the experience of Tibetan Buddhism?
Well, I found it very interesting. And of course, when one gets to the, the mystics and the saints, I mean, there's quite a lot of similarity up there. I mean, you know, in the lower echelons of doctrine, sometimes there are discrepancies, but when you get to the actual experiences, you know, I think there is a lot of unity going on. And so I just found it very interesting and in some ways very nourishing to, as a Westerner, reconnect with my own culture.
So I don't know if I know how to ask this exactly, but why does meditation work? There's a line in your book that says that Tibet has almost an assembly line that turns out enlightened people. So they've got it. They've got something going. There's a technique. Why, on a technical level, does it work? How does it work?
The thing is that our brains are, you know, much more soft and malleable than we normally imagine. And everything which we experience, you know, either externally or internally, we can only know because of our mind. But normally our minds are totally out of control, obviously. I mean, if they were not, nobody would be worrying about tomorrow's election, because who needs to worry? And, you know, if we were...
What do you mean by that? Nobody would worry because who needs to worry?
Well, I mean, it's going to happen whichever way. So why in the meantime be working yourself into a frazzle about it? You know, I mean, you cast your vote as you believe it to be. And then you have to wait and see what's going to happen, you know? I mean, getting all upset and, you know, agitated doesn't help anything, does
right,
it? Just
right.
makes the mind disturbed. And so, I mean, if we were left to ourselves, we would probably want to be happy, kind, peaceful sort of people. And the fact that most people are not happy, kind, or peaceful is because our minds are out of control. So even at that level, to learn how to be the masters of our mind instead of the slaves makes sense, doesn't it?
It does make sense. And is it possible to explain what's happening at a physiological level?
Well, nowadays they're doing a lot of research. Neuroscientists are doing a lot of research about what happens to the brain when people are meditating. And they have shown that those parts of the brain which create depression and upsets and anger, they shrink. And those parts of the brain which are related to happiness and joy and compassion and love, they grow and they radiate. I mean, they can see them on the machines. And people who have done many, many years of meditation, I mean, they're lit up like they've never seen in their lives. And even people who have done just a short amount of meditation, now they're doing a lot of tests on very ordinary people, not hermits or anything, just ordinary people, an hour of meditation a day. And they show that it changes the very chemical structure of the brain.
So at a certain point in your book, you talked about how your quest was to understand perfection. So what is perfection? And I'm sure many of our listeners consider themselves perfectionists, and maybe that is or is not such a great quality.
What I meant was, all right, normally we associate ourselves with our ordinary thinking processes and our ordinary emotions. And these are all revolving around this sense of me and mine and I, right? And so basically in our lives, usually the ego is in control, right? I want this. I don't like this. I think this. I want that. And so we think that this is our only reality. This is who I am. This is my name, this is my race, this is my gender, and so forth. And we identify ourselves totally with that. And with our opinions, our beliefs, our memories. And we think this is our reality and this is who I really am. But from the spiritual point of view, in one way, that's exactly who we are not. And that we are something so much more than we normally identify ourselves with. So we have behind all these thoughts and feelings and emotions, we have this primal, pure awareness which doesn't make the separation between self and others. I mean, our ordinary ego is always naturally very subjective. There's me and there's everything else which is not me. But in this state of primal, pure awareness, which is the very nature of wisdom and compassion, there's no sense of I or others. There's a very deep sense of our interconnection with all beings, not just human beings, but animals, insects, even trees and plants. I mean, it's not just Buddhists who realize this. I mean, anybody can realize this. But because we're so fascinated with our ordinary conceptual mind, we miss that awareness behind it, which is driving it. So it's compared with, like, the sky, which is vast and all-pervading, compared with our identifying with all the clouds.
And so perfection is that awareness that is transcendent of individual identity?
Exactly.
There's something that I've been trying to understand for a long time. Buddhism is respectful of science. Western science, and in a way it's probably one of the more scientific of the so-called religions, because you practice and learn based on your own experience rather than faith and taking things because somebody else told you that and because it's in scripture. And so you have in Tibetan Buddhism a web of life. You have the interconnection among all living beings,
right,
all sentient beings. You have that in Darwinian evolution as well. You have an interconnection among all the different life forms that are in this gigantic interconnected web of life that evolved over time. And those things are presumably not at odds with each other, but there is... I had a man on who was Tibetan, and he said something which has always stuck with me. He said there's something that every Tibetan person shares, from the humblest peasant to the highest lama, and that is the understanding that when a fly dies in a glass of water, that fly has a karma that could have been your mother in another life.
Right.
And there's a poignancy to that life being snuffed out, whereas in Darwinian evolution, it doesn't matter that life was snuffed out because it's not fit. It was not fit for survival. Right. And so in trying to understand these two worldviews of interconnected, gigantic, vast web of life, what are the similarities and what are the distinctions?
I must say, I never thought about it like that, but the point with the Buddhist is that we have a consciousness which continues. You see, Darwin is thinking you're just here in your physical embodiment. When the physical embodiment disappears, that's it, you're finished. That's it, a big void.
Right.
But of course, in Buddhism, you know, the physical embodiment might die, but the consciousness carries on, and so it takes another form. And so in that case, we have also been flies, we have also been humans, we have also been gods, we have also been everything. And since we have all been very... interconnected in very close relationships, which we don't remember anymore, therefore we have this very deep interconnection with all beings. I mean, for example, now from a Buddhist point of view, all right, you have your family in this lifetime, your parents and your siblings and your friends that you love very much and you care very much for. If they're in pain or if they're sick, you're really worried about them. Next lifetime, who knows where they're going to be? And if they turned up down the road and you didn't know them, you would be totally indifferent to them, right? And yet in this lifetime they were so important. So likewise, all the other beings that we see, we think they're not important, they have nothing to do with me, but in past lifetimes maybe we shared a very, very deep involvement. And therefore, just as we care for our parents and siblings and friends in this lifetime, we should realize that we've had that very deep relationship with all the beings that we meet at some point or other, even though we don't remember it anymore. And in this way also, we're very interconnected.
And so the distinction between that worldview and science is that consciousness is disembodied in the Buddhist worldview, whereas in evolution...
Well, it continues.
Yeah.
That's the point.
It continues.
And just as we have...
But you don't need a body for there to be consciousness.
Also.
And so what is the nature of that consciousness if it doesn't need to be in a human or canine or insect body?
Well, consciousness is not something which necessarily needs to be embodied. I mean, sometimes it's embodied and sometimes it's not. But it's this kind of energy.
Is it like a field, like the magnetic field?
In a way. But it's a single thing. I mean, because we believe that there is an I behind it all, that keeps it as a unity. Once we realize that concept of a separate individual everlasting me is just empty of any real, it's transparent, then that whole clinging to just one stream of consciousness disappears, and then one could have many streams of consciousness.
So is that, again, in when we're talking about experience versus faith, is that an understanding that you have experienced yourself versus That's the line that they give you and that you tell.
Well, personally, it is also the line. But if one is in meditating, then one of the points of meditating is, first of all, to understand, you know, the mind. Because, as I said, everything which we experience from outside and from inside, we only interpret through our thoughts and our thinking processes. So what's a thought? I mean, we'd never look. We never question it. We believe it. You know, if I think that so-and-so should be president, then that's the truth because I believe it, you know? And so we believe our thoughts and we believe our feelings and we don't see that they're transparent and that they're like bubbles, you know, very bright and shiny, but you go plick and it's just nothing, you know? And so then we look at the thought. What is a thought? Where does it come from? Where does it stay? Where does it go? What is the thought when you look at it, actually? And then behind that, who is thinking? And so the whole point is to try to see that our whole concept of a unitary, solid, everlasting me around which the rest of the universe revolves is the seat of our whole problem.
We're talking to Jetsunma Tenzin Palmo, who is a Tibetan Buddhist nun and teacher, and she will be speaking tomorrow night, Wednesday, at the Lensic at 7:30 in a talk titled Seeking the Heart of Wisdom. So another question that I have, Tibetan Buddhism has deities.
Mm-hmm.
What are deities?
Deities basically, they're on two levels, but basically, they represent various aspects of an enlightened consciousness. So there is, a bodhisattva, a deity, which is representing compassion, one that's representing wisdom, one that is representing purification, and so forth. And so it's in a way as if, I mean, ultimate reality, right, it has no color and no form. And so you can't grasp it with the mind because by its very nature, it's beyond thought. So then if you consider it like a prism, right, like a crystal, which is completely clear and transparent, then if you send light through it, it will create a rainbow. And so that rainbow we can see. And so that's like the deities. They are like an emanation from ultimate reality, which we cannot see and we cannot grasp. So because our minds are relative and like to hold on to something, so therefore ultimate reality displays these different forms so that we can catch on to it and visualize ourselves as that deity. It's not that it's something outside ourselves, but it's our true nature if we could only see things clearly.
There are deities in many different cultures. Are they the same? I mean, are they essentially the same thing, whether you're talking about in Buddhism or in, let's say, African culture or in Inca culture? Are they essentially the same emanations of light coming through the prism, to use that metaphor?
I think it would depend on how you respond to it. If you think that the deity, I mean, there are also nature deities who bring the rain and help the harvest and things like that. That's not what we're talking about. And anything which is like a representation of wisdom and is not just outside of ourselves but is a reflection of our true nature, then anyone that reacts to it in that way, then that would be aligned with the Buddhist ideas of divinity. Because, of course, Buddhism is a non-theistic religion. And so even with all these bodhisattvas and Buddhas, none of them are judging us. None of them created the world. They're all on our side. And they just are emanations of wisdom and compassion and so forth, which is our true nature. So they are just a reflection of who we really are.
I guess, and maybe this is just a silly question, but in the same way that you and I are two different people with two different bodies, and we have different sets of thoughts, and maybe in the big picture that's not true, but here we're sitting at this table and there's people out in their cars driving listening to us right now. Are these deities of compassion, are they real, or do we just make them up?
One of the most popular of the Tibetan deities is called Tara. And she is a bodhisattva of compassion. She is also a bodhisattva of enlightened action. So people pray to her a lot for help. And of course, people do meditations in which they see themselves as Tara. And somebody asked the Lama if Tara really existed, if she was really out there. Was she really real? And the Lama thought, and then he says, she knows that she is not real.
So that's a paradox.
And I think that sets it up.
Well, in the same way that maybe you or I know that we're not real.
But we think we are.
But we think we are.
So, and that's the difference. She knows she's not.
But she is, yeah, it's... So... In Buddhism, there's also things called realms of heaven and hell. What are they?
What are realms of heaven and hell? If one has done very evil things and delights in evil, then the mind is full of, you know, very vicious thoughts. When we die, since what we are thinking in our mind then becomes projected outside of ourselves because we don't have any body, then we will see very difficult, vicious, and threatening phantasms. And we will not realize that that is just a projection of our own perverted mind, but we will think that this is something which is threatening us and harming us. And so we will feel all the more angry and upset. And so it creates this cycle.
This is after we've died.
Yes, after we died.
So this consciousness that isn't real, that is called Mary Charlotte or Tenzin Palmo, is still conscious and is still experiencing
things.
Absolutely. So what is the process like? What is the actual thing that happens when I die or you die and we go on to the next thing? What happens to that bit of consciousness? It must retain some identity if it is going to experience heaven and hell, but it must lose some identity too when it loses the body and the name and the address and all those things.
Well, I mean, in the Tibetan system, it's really quite complex, and I can't go into it here. But anyway, the point is that the various gross elements of the body dissolve one into the other. And then the very...
By gross elements?
Like the heat in the body and the moisture in the body and so forth, they... You know, when people are dying, if they're dying fairly slowly, you can feel that the body begins to get heavy and they lose the feeling in the extremities, and then their body feels very dry and their throat begins to close up and so forth. And then the gross consciousness, our ordinary consciousness, dissolves into a more subtle consciousness, the subconscious, so to speak. And then the subconscious dissolves into what is called a very subtle consciousness, which is called the clear light nature of the mind, which is the ultimate reality of the mind. But normally, for ordinary people who have never experienced that, then they take a bit of a shock, and then they immediately kind of go into a deep swoon. When they come out of that, they're in what is called the intermediary state, where they have a mind body, which is akin to the body we have right now. But because it's not a physical body, then it's very difficult to take control of it. And then it experiences various different visions and whatever. And then slowly, at a certain point, it's considered to last for 7 weeks, often this intermediary period. One is attracted to one's next place of rebirth, depending on the karma. And, you know, perhaps if you're going to be reborn as a human again, then you will see your future parents copulating, and you're very drawn. If you're a boy, going to be reborn as a boy, then you're attracted to your mother and you don't like your father. And if you're the opposite way, if you're a girl, then you're attracted to the father and you don't like the mother, and you try to get in between them. And then
that's hilarious. You have Oedipal complex even in...
Absolutely. It was there before Freud ever came around. And then you find yourself reborn inside the womb of the mother.
And but you might come back as an
anything.
Insect or a house pet, or
if you have made the karma to do so.
Now, what is karma?
Karma means action, and it means basically any intentional actions, intentional, not unintentional, intentional actions of body, speech, and mind. All our intentional actions create kind of seeds in the consciousness, and then in time, when there are causes and conditions come together, then they will ripen.
That's an interesting distinction between intentional and unintentional, and I would think there's sort of a gray area between the two. A lot of us do very unpleasant things that are unintentional, but it's out of a lack of caring or consciousness.
Yes, so that in itself, because it was in, often if we react from our delusory state of mind, that's also a kind of negative consciousness. But what it means is, like, supposing you're walking along the road and you step on an ant, but you didn't see the ant, then that doesn't make karma. But if you see an ant and you think, aha, an ant, squish, then that's making karma, because the intention was to kill it.
Now, you had a very unusual calling, which was to be an young English woman deciding to become a Tibetan Buddhist nun and devoting your life to a very serious practice. Some people are called to have horrible lives, like to be in the mafia, and that's what they want to do, and that's what they do. How do you understand that kind of really bad karma?
Well, presumably because in past lives they made the causes and conditions to come back with a kind of mind in the kind of families and company which they find themselves.
And so is there a trajectory toward improvement, toward loving kindness, or is it just all a big mess?
I mean, you know, it's like a game of snakes and ladders, you know. There are a few ladders and lots of snakes. So we can go up and we can go down. It depends on us. This is the whole point, that we have a choice. I mean, some people find themselves in the most awful families, in the most awful circumstances, with the most dreadful companions, but something inside them tells them this is not what I want, and they go beyond that. Other people are born in really very good families with every possible advantage, and they go bad.
And I guess, what, you know, you as not only a practitioner, but as a teacher, trying to make the world a better place, is that what you are doing, trying to make the world a better place?
Well, I'm trying to help people to clarify their lives a little bit so that, you know, they can use this human life for something which brings benefit to themselves and benefit to others. I mean, you know, that's the least you can do, is to try to point a few things out. Whether people take it up or not is up to them.
I guess because of being an American, we have this idea that their progress is possible and that the world can be on a movement toward just more fairness, more justice, more loving kindness, to use that language. And I wonder whether in the Buddhist tradition there is this sense of humanity actually being able to improve itself or not.
To be quite honest, I think most the traditional Buddhist view is that we are probably getting worse. And that this is the age of degeneracy. And on the whole, people can be improved themselves. And of course, people can be liberated. And of course, there is a lot of lots and lots of good in the world. But I think the idea is that because we are caught up so often in our ego delusion and our greed and our anger and hatred, it's very difficult for us. But of course, the whole point of the Buddhist path is to recognize those feelings inside ourselves and use methods to overcome them and transform them.
You had a guru.
Because we all have Buddha nature, so that right. We're trying to come back to who we really are.
Well, I guess that's the thing. If we all have Buddha natures and we're trying to come back to that, there would be, one would think or hope over time, this sense of shedding the not-so-nice natures and coming to that truth within.
Well, we hope. I mean, the point is that, of course, some people do, but sometimes we make it even darker. I mean, that's always up to us.
Do animals have Buddha natures?
Of course.
But cats will always eat other...
That's because of the karmic imprints. But it doesn't mean that eventually they might not begin to start going up.
Can they do that as animals, or do they have to be humans?
Well, usually you have to get a human birth, because it's in the human birth that you're able to do spiritual practices, which an animal usually is not. But an animal could make a good connection and then next lifetime come back as a human.
So you studied with a guru. What is the nature of the relationship between disciple and guru?
Well, ideally, one sees one's teacher as the embodiment of what we're striving for. In other words, one sees them as the Buddha. And the main point is the devotion based on trust. That's why one has to be very careful, because one has to believe that they understand oneself better than one does, and that what they are telling one to do is what is right. So therefore, one has to be very careful in making a choice of a guru, and not just be caught up in their charisma or the fact they've got lots and lots of disciples, or that they tell you they're enlightened, which...
That should be a red flag right there.
Exactly. I can't believe how many Americans go around telling us they're enlightened. I find it quite alarming, actually.
Well, you had a guru who was, when you were a young woman, who was feeling up under your skirt.
Oh, well, he wasn't my guru. He was just somebody I met.
Oh, he was a teacher who was a guru to many people.
Yes, yes.
And it seems like trust would have to evaporate immediately under those circumstances.
Well, I mean, I only just met him. So, yes, I mean, well, but he was famous for being quite outrageous.
So... why do you think so many people in the West in the last, 50 to 75 years have been drawn to Buddhism and Eastern meditation practices?
I think because a lot of people now are in a position where they can see that merely material prosperity and comfort doesn't actually give any more meaning to life. And a lot of people, I think, do feel that their lives are pretty meaningless. They've, they have nice houses and lots more cars than they need, and they have everything which our consumer society assures us is all we need for unalloyed joy. But they're not joyous, and so they have they're at the point where they can look and think, no, there must be something more to life than this. What am I doing? And Asian religions on the whole have not, they're not just telling you to be good or to be kind and to be compassionate, but they're giving techniques by which one can actually transform and develop.
I sometimes, in the winter, when I put on a fleece jacket and fleece pants, feel very happy. And I think, you know, these things shouldn't be making, they're material things, but they make me so happy. And I'm grateful for them. How do you? And it makes me wonder, what's happiness? Because there's so many different kinds, so many different definitions that people put onto that word.
Well, I think happiness isn't just pleasurable feelings or, having fun. I think that a genuine happiness is a kind of wellspring of inner joy, which just bubbles up and has nothing whatsoever really to do with external circumstances. So that even if you was freezing cold and didn't have fleecy coats to put on, you would still feel this inner joy just bubbling up, just having nothing whatsoever to do with, you know, your physical well-being.
For so many people, that's not the experience, though. We feel happy when we've just had a good meal, or when we love, or when all those things.
That's not true happiness. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is a state of very profound inner well-being, so that even if you're being tortured, you have this feeling of inner joy and compassion.
I wonder if they put the people on those machines where they can see their brains lighting up and the happiness parts after they've had a good meal versus the kind of joy that you're talking about. Is it different? Is it the same part of the brain?
The thing is that the people who were tested often had to spend like 3 hours inside a CAT scan machine. They were not just having a good meal, and they had to, you know, 3 hours inside one of those enclosures.
And that'll mess up your equanimity.
They still showed nothing but compassion and joy. So I think that's a pretty good test.
What are you up to now? What are you doing these days?
Well, right now I'm sitting in this cafe in Santa Fe. So I'm in New Mexico for just a few days, and then from there we go to Oregon, and then from there to California. So I'm in the States about 6 weeks.
Do you have a home base where you live?
I live in northern India. We have a nunnery there.
Tell us about the nunnery.
It's a nunnery for girls from Tibet and from the various other Himalayan regions like Ladakh and Spiti. Traditionally, nuns in the Tibetan tradition were not given much education.
Unlike their male counterparts.
Unlike their male counterparts. And so in recent years, there's been a reappraisal of this whole situation. And nowadays, nuns are being given the opportunity to study philosophy and debating, and also to do long-term retreats, and in fact to have all the spiritual and intellectual advantages which the monks tend to take for granted.
Jetsunma Tenzin Palmo, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
And the website is tenzinpalmo.com. It's TENZINPALMO.com. And she will be speaking tomorrow, Wednesday, November 5th at 7:30 at the Lenzec here in Santa Fe at a talk titled Seeking the Heart of Wisdom. And she's also going to be giving a short talk at the Upaya Zen Center on the same day tomorrow at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And this is election day, ladies and gentlemen, so don't forget, if you haven't voted yet, go out and vote if you possibly can. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Nick and Mary Lynn for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.